This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode, Mental Health in Times of Crisis. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Maren Sardi remembers the exact moment she realized her brother Tom was not well.
My brother called me on the phone and he started talking about matrices that he was creating in his head.
Tom was in his early 20s. He had recently dropped out of college. He'd always been a little quirky. But on this call, the longer they talked, the more strange things he said.
That he was generating these images and manipulating them. It was as if it was a complete reality that he was engaging with.
Maren doesn't remember all of the details, but she was devastated after the call ended.
And just completely fell into a state of, you know, panic and terror and crying.
Because Maren knew what this was. She knew her brother was in the throes of a mental health crisis, but she didn't know what to do next. Liz Tong picks up the story from there.
The reason Maren knew immediately what was happening to her brother is because she'd seen it before.
In the case of my mother, who had developed schizophrenia when I was about 10 years old,
Maren wrote a memoir about mental illness and her family. It's called The Edge of Everyday: Sketches of Schizophrenia. In the book, she calls schizophrenia the shapeless thief. Because to Maren, that's what it felt like. Like her mother had been stolen away, yanked out from the world they shared together, and sealed off into the cave of her own mind. Schizophrenia is a profoundly isolating disease, thanks in large part to its biggest and most destructive symptom, psychosis, which is when someone loses touch with reality and becomes immersed in their own delusions. Maren's mom, for instance, became obsessed with the idea that someone or something was after her. Sometimes she'd make their family stay at a hotel to hide out, or barricade them in the house to protect them from assassins. As you might imagine, all of this led to a pretty chaotic home life for her four kids. Maren, her two sisters, and Tom, the baby of the family.
When we were at my mother's house, my brother and my younger sister and I were a little bit feral, I think you could say.
They lived in Anchorage, Alaska, and Maren says she and her siblings ran wild around the neighborhood. They came to rely on each other, bonding in a way that only kids raised in the midst of chaos and trauma can. Maren says she had an especially deep connection with Tom.
Tom was the sibling that I was most like and who I related to on a deep level.
In a world that felt unsafe and unpredictable, Tom made her feel brave. He was fearless.
I was always very hesitant. I was always very sensitive. I would hang back. I would fret. And so Tom was important to me as a person who could kind of cut through that and help me, like, get things done.
Even into their 20s, Tom was Maren's rock. He was the family peacemaker, the problem solver, which maybe is why it took a while for Maren to realize that something was wrong. It wasn't until that one bizarre phone call that the truth of what was happening to Tom exploded into her mind with crushing clarity.
And honestly, I don't remember exactly what he said that really made it clear to me.
Maren had seen what schizophrenia did to her mother. How it took away the life she could have had, the life they could have had together. Now, it looked like the same shapeless thief had come for her brother. It filled her with panic and desperation and grief.
My experience with my mother had sort of trained me to feel powerless. I think part of me just assumed there was nothing I was going to be able to do for my brother, and I think I was crying about that too.
Schizophrenia is one of the most disabling mental illnesses out there. It affects everything. Cognitive function, ability to communicate, relationships, health. A lot of the worst outcomes can be warded off with early treatment, medication, and therapy. But there's a catch, a pretty cruel one. Because of how schizophrenia affects the brain, a lot of people who have it don't realize they're actually sick.
Tom just sort of outright rejected the idea that there was a problem, and so there were a lot of different things that happened over those couple of years.
Tom lost his job, then his apartment, and eventually ended up on the street. But even then, he still refused to acknowledge something was wrong or that he needed help. So Maren went online looking for advice.
I Googled the question, how do you convince someone with schizophrenia to seek treatment? And what I found was very little actual advice on how to do that. Instead, what I found was a broad network of people who were in my position, loved ones, family members, who were trying to figure out how to help people that they loved and were communicating with each other and just trying to sort of fill that hole.
This is a problem that families across the country deal with. Dominic Sisti, who's a medical ethicist at the University of Pennsylvania, says that's in part because of our legal standard for involuntary hospitalization.
We have such a high bar for providing treatment to individuals that a lot of individuals who don't meet that high bar, that threshold, are left out in the cold.
In most states, people have to present a clear and present danger to themselves or others, which has been broadly interpreted to mean they have to be violent in order to be committed. John Snook, who heads up a nonprofit called the Treatment Advocacy Center, says as a policy, that does not make sense.
Because the reality is most people who are mentally ill aren't violent. And so if you have a standard that's based on violence, that means most people can't get care. And that's a dumb way to do things.
These days, John says, people with mental illness are way more likely to end up in a jail cell than a hospital bed. That's exactly what happened to Marin's brother, Tom. As his mental health declined, so did the rest of his life. He spent most of his time roaming around Anchorage and started having regular run-ins with the law.
And he got arrested for loitering. And that arrest sort of set off a legal process that ultimately led to Tom being sent through the mental health court in Anchorage.
In lieu of punishment, Tom received a diagnosis, schizophrenia, just as Marin had suspected, along with mandated treatment, an antipsychotic called risperidone and twice-weekly group therapy. Over the next several months, things started turning around for Tom. Tom moved in with their dad, got a job, and enrolled in a writing class at the University of Alaska. But it didn't last.
He felt that the schizophrenia diagnosis was incorrect, and I think he felt embarrassed. I spoke to one of Tom's best friends, and he told me that Tom told him that every day when he had to take that antipsychotic pill, he felt embarrassed.
So when Tom's court-mandated treatment was up, he stopped taking his medication. It wasn't long before he was back on the streets. He'd sleep in shelters sometimes and camp out whenever he could, even during Anchorage's freezing winters.
It was agonizing for all of us. There was a background level of fear that would come on in October and wouldn't leave again until April.
Their dad started buying high-quality winter gear, fleece-lined pants, wool sweaters, new boots, to give to Tom whenever he could find him. During cold snaps, he'd scan the papers for items about homeless men who'd frozen to death outside. The family went on for years like this, trapped in a kind of purgatory of helplessness. But Marin didn't give up. She moved away, but then in 2009 decided to give it another shot. She figured maybe she could be the one to convince Tom to come back. So she flew into Anchorage, and after a few days of looking, finally managed to find Tom.
As soon as I saw him, tears started running down my cheeks. And the first thing he said was, "Have you figured out I'm your brother yet?" And I was like, "Hi, Tom." And then he saw me crying and he said, "Yeah, times are hard all around."
Marin tried taking Tom to lunch, but he got spooked by the busy restaurant. So instead, she bought him a sandwich and they went on a walk. He talked and Marin listened. The conversation was confusing, hard to follow. In the gaps, Marin would try to feel him out about getting treatment or coming home, but he just waved her suggestions away. Finally, after about an hour, Tom decided their walk was done. To Marin, it seemed like progress. Until, as she was about to leave, he said this.
"Do you remember the time that you tried to kill me?" At that point, I understood that the distance that Tom's illness created between him and us was going to be insurmountable. I had no idea what else to do.
So Marin flew home. a few more winters passed with almost no contact. And then in February 2014, something changed. Tom got arrested again and was again sent to the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. But this time, Tom seemed different.
He was completely accepting treatment. By that time, he decided that he was going to do what the system required him to get off the street and stay off the street.
Marin's dad called to tell her the news.
It was one of those moments of, should I allow myself to feel elated right now? On the one hand, it was... I'm sorry. On the one hand, it was our dream coming true.
On the other hand, she had no idea if it was going to stick. But that didn't stop her from celebrating.
I was bouncing around, you know? I was so happy.
This time, it wasn't a quick in-and-out hospitalization. They let Tom stay for months, and he finally got a lot of the help he needed. Marin got a chance to talk with her brother 4 months into his stay. It was the most coherent, the most himself had sounded in years. But he also sounded worried.
He was afraid that once he was out of the psych hospital, he was not going to be able to get his hands on medication. And he was afraid that if he couldn't get his medication, then they would kick him out of the halfway house and that he would be homeless again. He said that he thought that the only thing he could do was to go to jail. He felt that that was the only option left for him.
Marin tried to convince him otherwise, but she wasn't sure he believed her. In the run-up to his release, things were looking good. Tom had been accepted to a halfway house that he liked and was getting ready to be discharged. So it's hard to say exactly why Tom did what he did, just a couple days before his release.
One day at lunch, he slipped away. He knew that they wouldn't notice him gone because it was the lunch hour. He locked himself in a bathroom and he died by suicide.
Years later, Marin wonders how things could have been different for her brother. She says the treatment system is really hard to navigate, even for people who are actively seeking help. But for people with schizophrenia, who don't even think they need help, they can feel hopeless.
Bureaucracy has its own way of doing things, and you have to conform to bureaucracy's mode. And schizophrenia doesn't conform to anyone except schizophrenia. And for a mental health care system to require schizophrenia to be different from how schizophrenia is, or in order for a person to recover, that's madness.
If you ask John Snook, the head of the Treatment Advocacy Center, stories like this are inevitable in a system that provides too little, too late.
A crisis-focused mental health system fails to get people care before they're in their most desperate state. Just like any other illness, we want to get people care before they're in crisis, before they have to suffer. And we want to make sure that treatment is as effective, as kind, and as recovery-oriented as possible.
So what's the answer? How do we fix this broken system? The experts I talked to had a lot of ideas, from bringing back asylums to changing the standard for involuntary hospitalization. But one thing they all agreed on is that we need to get to people earlier. Here's Dominic.
If we can figure out ways to intervene early, we might be able to, in fact, prevent the need for involuntary treatment.
There are actually some places that are already doing this, using what are called early psychosis programs. It's part of implementing what Dominic and John call a continuum of care, basically the opposite of acute crisis-centered care, not just treating people when they're at their worst, but working hard to prevent crises before they happen. It seems to be working, but how do we expand that approach to a national level? Experts say it could require some pretty big fixes. For instance, integrating physical and mental health care, scrapping a Medicaid rule that prevents federal reimbursements for mental health care, enforcing parity laws that require insurance to cover mental health care as well as it does physical. But other solutions are surprisingly low-tech. Marin came across one of them after publishing her memoir, a nonprofit in Midtown Manhattan called Fountain House, which she later said she thinks could have saved Tom's life.
This is a big, beautiful space.
I know. This is probably the nicest unit we have. It's got this great view of the city.
It is an incredible place. They have a kitchen.
It's very cool. They
have, gym.
We have elliptical machines. We have bikes.
A plant nursery.
Okay, let me show you the hydroponic room.
A media center. A job resource center.
Nationwide all-year birthday party. Oh.
And everywhere you go, you see people working, talking, interacting.
Bonus card, eat healthy and live long.
Which Fountain House's president and CEO, Ashwin Vasan, says is by design.
Something that mental illness really takes away from you is your ability to connect with someone else, right? And so it's very much about just being a part of the community and working. We don't really care what your diagnosis is. You know, it's not about that. We don't treat people as a diagnosis. We treat people as people.
It's what they call a clubhouse model. The people who go there aren't patients, they're members. And they come to Fountain House every day to work in units that produce newsletters or grow plants or serve food. It gives them a reason to get up in the morning, along with accountability when things get rough.
Our members do not cycle in and out of jail. They do not cycle in and out of homelessness. They don't cycle in and out of emergency rooms. And why is that? Because they know that when they're struggling, when they're facing any challenge, they can come here. They're surrounded by resources and supports where they can manage that situation.
One member I talked to, Roberto, he only wanted to give his first name, was in a similar situation to Tom a few years ago, in and out of homeless shelters and halfway houses with not much reason to stick to his treatment. But he says Fountain House has changed that.
I don't isolate anymore, which is a big thing for me, because I could stay in my little studio apartment all day and not pick up the phone or anything and just stay in my own head. And Fountain House, you know, it's good. It helps me, you know, stay focused. I'm more consistent in taking my medication now. Because before, when I was isolated in the shelter, if I took it, I took it. If I didn't, oh well, no big thing. But Fountain House gives me a purpose and a place to come to every day.
That story was reported by Liz Tan.